session number 17365, reel 4.
Mr. Waddington, reel 4.
How many did I say? 2,000 tons of bombs. More than 2,000. Now, when you think that this raid would perhaps take 20 or 30 minutes, I mean, it's not far off 100 tons a minute. So in about 5 minutes, Berlin would receive as many bombs as Hull lost in 6 years of war. I mean, that takes a bit of believing, but I'm only quoting these figures from this book. I know the tonnage on Berlin, what that was, because I've read about that. So that's rather remarkable. So, it came then to the 20th of January 1944. It was a Thursday. And, as I've said, in the briefing room, it was disclosed that it was Berlin, and everybody groaned. And so we were briefed, but by that I mean you were told what the bomb load was, you were told what your route was. You always had to fly a certain route, which was up on the map. The navigators had to take this route down and work out their courses and their estimated times of arrival. Now, on this raid, we weren't going to fly straight there. They were trying a different tactic. They found by flying straight there that the Germans soon knew what the target was. This time we were going to fly sort of northeast along slightly north of the Frisian Islands. By the time we got to about Kiel, we were going to turn into Germany and fly southeast for so long, and then I think turn south and fly over Berlin. These turning points were vital. The navigation had to be terribly accurate. You had to work out your turning points to 10 seconds, a tenth of a minute. Because if you came to a sort of a right angle turn and you turned a minute late, you were going at 150, 180 miles an hour, you were quite a way beyond where you should be. And say on your next leg, you'd be outside the stream. They used to fly in streams. They used to try and keep them as close together as possible. Well, that was up to the navigators. But it also was, the stream was as long as the raid took. In this case, it was 25 minutes. So it would be, if possible, 5 miles wide and 80 miles long, something like this. So you had to be accurate in your navigation. So anyway, we made these courses, and we probably got some pictures on the H2S when we crossed the German coast. And eventually the pilot said that he could see the flares going down at Berlin. It was a great relief to me as a navigator. Whilst we were pathfinding, we weren't carrying flares on this occasion because it was our first trip. We had to do a few trips carrying bombs, but we were bombing at 0-2, which is 2 minutes before the raid officially starts. Up till then, there wouldn't be any bombs, they'd be just coloured flares. They used to be different colours, meaning different things, which I forget now what they were. So away we sailed over Berlin. The bomb aimer got into position. We had a bomb aimer then. Of course, I wasn't doing the bombing, and he was right up at the front of the aeroplane, lying down on his tummy. Behind him, up two or three steps, was where the pilot and the flight engineer sat. The pilot on the left, and then there was a curtain, and behind the curtain, with lights on, was me and the wireless op. I was facing to the port side, which meant that my right-hand side was facing the way the aeroplane was going, and Andy, dear Andy, who was also on his second tour, was a wireless up, and he was sitting facing forwards. Behind him, in the mid-upper turret, was dear old Raymond Ridley, who was 40, like a grandpa to us, and away at the back was a stranger. Our ray gunner was sick, and we had this poor stranger in. I mean, I always thought he was... I didn't know him. I always thought his name was Smith, but Bird Smith said it's Brown. Anyway, he was a warrant officer, and I think he was on his second tour, I think. So, Bartholomew was the bomb aimer, and he's calling out instructions to the pilot as he picks up the target, which it was just an aiming point, I think, in Berlin. And he said, bomb's gone, I've got the course ready for the pilot. I'm just going to switch on my intercom and tell him, when the rear gunner called out, look out! That's all he said, look out. Well, what Baird Smith was supposed to do on those instructions, I don't really know. But then there were these things hitting us. I presume they were cannon shells. It was thuds. The rear gunner, I mean, I've no idea what he saw or how much notice he'd got, but I mean, he should, if he sees a fighter, he should say to the pilot, there's a fighter on the port quarter or the starboard bow or something. Then the pilot, who's looking the other way, thinks, right, there's a fighter there. So he turns hard over into the direction where the fighter is, in the hope that he is a tight turn, that the fighter who's going faster will pass him and lose us. But he never said that at all. There was then dead silence. The engine stopped. Nobody spoke except me. Baird Smith was perhaps just weighing up the thing as to how much damage we'd got. But I said, shall we bail out, Skipper? And Baird Smith said, yes, bail out. And that was all that was said. Nobody else said anything. We didn't even say, good luck, chaps, or anything at all. Now, I think I grew up then, in those minutes there, because whilst I'd been drinking to try to get to sleep, thinking about this incident, when it happened, it was just quite remarkable. I was so calm. Everybody was calm. There was no panic. He went fighting and pushing people out of the way to get out. You knew what to do. You knew, I mean, from Andrews, me, those two, pilot and flight engineer and thing, we all had to go out to the front door. The rear gunner would just swivel his turret and open the doors and fall out. Poor old Raymond Ridley at 40 wouldn't have any chance of getting out. All his flying gear. No, but I mean, I never gave a thought to what they were doing. I just knew that I'd got to get out. So I put my parachute on. He sat on your parachute. The navigator sat on his parachute, and he'd already got your harness on, and it hooked on two hooks on your chest. And when it opened, there was a sort of double strap from your shoulders down to these hooks, and it was lightly sewn on this, so that when your parachute opened, it pulled it up, and the two things up there, and that was your parachute up there like that. So anyway, I went forward through the curtain. I think the lights must have still been on, which is quite remarkable. And there was nobody there. I mean, the pilot had gone. I don't blame him, really, but I always imagined that the pilots would stay till everybody had got out. There was a man in front of me, which must have been Baird Smith, because there were two steps there, and as the flight engineer sat on the right, which is the same side as the steps, he would have gone first. So as I moved forward, I felt Andy's hand on my right shoulder. And I got into the pilot's compartment, and I could see that the control column or joystick or whatever it's called was pressed right forward like that. So I leant over and got hold of it to try and pull it to straighten up the aeroplane. I think I could see that we were going down head first because the fires on the ground were quite slowly turning, which they wouldn't have been turning, but the plane was turning. Couldn't shift this, came back here, stood there, and in that instant the plane blew up. It actually exploded. Bert Smith there, Johnson, the call of flight engineers in front of him, and Bartholomew. Whether anybody had got out or not, I don't really know. Andrews is just here behind me. And I can remember as plain as anything, this going through this opening in the plane here. It just opened and I went through it. And I'm out in the night sky. It's dark, of course. It's 7:30 in the evening only. In January. So I put my hand here to pull my parachute, and it wasn't there. I thought, oh. I remember thinking, oh, God, I've forgotten it, or something like this. Then, why you think of these things, I don't know. I knew instantly what had happened. In the explosion, it had come off here, and it was here.
Above your head.
Whichever way, I didn't know it was upside down. There's no sense of falling when you're on a parachute in the dark, because you're not passing anything. You don't feel as though you're falling at all, and I had no idea which way up I was. I put my hand up here, and it's on this side, and I pulled it like that. With an almighty jerk, it opened. And I never remember looking down at the ground at all to see anything. I was just concentrating on what I was doing. And we'd been told that when you come down on a parachute, after a while it starts to gently swing, like this. And you've got to stop it swinging, because you're going down at a fair speed, and if you happen to land on a downward thing as well, you're more likely to hurt yourself than if it's static. So I put my hand up like this, and I was just thinking, now which side do I pull? And I was on this pavement outside somebody's garden gate. Just reminded me of James Reckitt Avenue. It's that sort of house with a small front garden. I must only have got the parachute open in the nick of time, or so I'd have been just splattered to bits on this pavement. So the first thing I thought of was, oh, by the way, I forgot to mention this, they do say that when you're in this kind of danger, the whole life passes before you, which my whole life didn't pass, but I did think about my mother. In a very short time between being blown out and landing, I just thought about mother, I don't know really why. So, right, I'm here on this pavement, and then to my horror, I realised that we were bombing at -2. So there was 2,000 tonnes of bombs going to fall on me. I thought, well, I better get into a shelter. And then I thought, well, no, I can't really see myself knocking on the door and saying, can I come in? Can I come in, please? I might not have been well received. So there's a hard backing from the parachute. I put it over my head, and I crawled up small, and nobody knew I was there at all. What's that? Christopher Robin crawled up small, and nobody knew he was there at all. And this shattering noise went on as these bombs, the earth was shaking. There was none really terribly near, but it was terrible. When it began to quieten down, two men approached. And so I stood up. I was a bit unsteady on my legs. I think it was being... I mean, I was lucky in a sense that I must have been completely relaxed when I landed. I didn't got stiff legs. They must have been relaxed. But I did have difficulty walking. So this fella said in German, was I Deutsch? And having done a year's German at Hammers, I said, nein, ich bin Engländer, or something like this. So they could see that I couldn't walk very well, so they helped me. I put my arms around both of them, and off we went to a police station. I don't really know how far, half a mile.
Is this Berlin?
This is in Berlin. This is in Berlin itself, yes. Yes. You see, we'd only just dropped the bombs. We were just about to turn for home. So we went down these steps into this police station, and suddenly I was given a bloody great shove from the back. And it was then they began to realise that I was in a bit of a difficult position. I mean, we had heard stories about people, Germans, been thrown into the flames in Hull and all this kind of horrible thing, and you began to really wonder. So, strangely enough, in front of me was Bartholomew with two Germans, only a little distance. He marched straight on and into a room on the left, and I went into the first room on the left, which was quite a sizable room. They searched me, found I got some fags, which they took and smoked. I'd also got an escape kit, which everybody carried, which had a silk handkerchief with a map of Germany on to enable you to walk home, some Horlick pills, and I don't know what else, a compass. Then all these policemen went out of the room. Because my legs were a bit dodgy, I sat down. There was a form behind me. And it was then that I noticed, it's up at that corner of the room, it was quite a long room, there were about three women sobbing, covered in soot. You know, obviously, bomb victims. Then this big fat policeman came back in, and when he saw that I was sitting down, I mean, I'd just stood up straight away, anything to oblige, he just rushed at me and started punching me. Well, I mean, I couldn't do anything. I don't even look him in the eyes in case he could see hatred or anger or anything. I just stood there with my eyes down. Felt utterly humiliated, really. But, I mean, I had to save my life, didn't I? I mean, for two pins, they would have strung me up, I should imagine. That was really all. And then was taken upstairs and put in a what you might call a cell. It was a room with a double bed in it, one on top of the other. I don't mean a big 5 foot bed. I mean bunks, you know, bunk. Got onto the bottom bunk, and look us though. Then it's maybe only 9 o'clock in the evening. And I suppose I felt a bit homesick really, but I just stayed there. And after a while, there were no lights on, of course. After a while. There was a light under the door. After a while, the door opened, so up I stood, stir attention, and there's this fella standing there. If he wasn't a Gestapo man, he was certainly doing a good impression of one. He had a long black overcoat on, with his hands deep in his pockets, a trilby hat on, and he just stood and looked at me. And I thought, any minute there's going to be a flash, and there's going to be a bloody bullet right into my stomach. But it didn't happen that way. He said, was I Canadian or was I English? In English, he said this. I said I was English. Do the English usually murder women and children? He said to me. I said, no, not as a rule. And he stood and he looked at me. And then he shut the door and went. So I got back on the bed. I don't know if I went to sleep again, but another policeman came in about 2 a.m, and he was much nicer. Asked me if there's anything I wanted. I said, well, I'd like a pee and I'd like a drink of water. So So he took me out, and I think he was rather intrigued by me as being a flyer. As being a flyer, as a bit not engrossed, impressed, perhaps, is not really quite the right word. He seemed to be respectful. And, I mean, I was very suspicious of anybody who spoke to me in case they were interrogating me, you know. But he didn't do that. He was a very smartly dressed policeman. I think he must have been an officer. But he did ask me where my home was. Well, I was not giving him any secrets to tell him that I came from Hull. And he said that he'd been to Hull before the war on business. And just a nice little chat, and I went back again, and that was it, really. And then it was breakfast time, and I was taken downstairs and had this, I don't know what I had, and then out I went into, and it was about 7:30 in the morning, it was still dark in Berlin. Got into this ambulance, and there was Bartholomew in as well. And in between us, there's a German soldier, or Luftwaffe, or whatever he was. So when I tried to talk to me, he told me to, you know, shut up. So we drove, I went to a hospital. But of a very, very rough, like cobblestone roads, it felt like, and Bartholomew was moaning. He was holding his neck like this, and like that. And I thought, oh God, you know, not in front of the Germans. I wish you'd shut up. I should never have thought that, because he died a few days later. I didn't know that. We went to this hospital, and by which time it was daylight, and I was put into a ward with about 10 other RAF fellas, all RAF. I can never remember talking to Bartholomew while I was in there, and I must have been in an hour or two. I was examined. All I'd got was a very bad cut on that hand. In one of the beds, there was a fella that I knew very well, who was unconscious, and he was moaning and groaning, and a few of us helped to move him, to make him a bit more comfortable. They call him Arthur Jones. Arthur Jones was a squadron leader who eventually came to the camp I was in, and he told me how he'd got shot down and how he'd been very badly injured. He'd broken his thigh bone, he'd broken his pelvis and all this stuff. And we became very good friends in Stalag 3. In fact, I went to his christening. He'd never been christened, but he wanted to be christened. So one afternoon with the parson, I was a sort of godparent to him, as he was christened, baptised. After the war, he emigrated, and one time to Australia, and one time he came to see us and stayed a night or two here. It was good to see him again. We always used to exchange Christmas cards. Then one year, his card didn't come. And I thought, oh, he must have died. Well, not long afterwards, we got a letter from his wife to say that he was dead. He'd been mending his van. He'd got it propped up with bloody bricks. And it had fallen on him and killed him, crushed him on his chest. Poor old Arthur Jones. So after a short time, then I was taken out, and I was taken across the road to some barracks, and it was a very, very peculiar feeling to be in Berlin. It's like 11, 12 o'clock in the morning. Yesterday, I was at Erkington, and here I am in Berlin. Alas vor der Krieg, these great big notices up and all this kind of stuff that sort of was here in English. And I went across to, there were soldiers, I think, and they were perfectly harmless to me. They gave me something to eat. I really could hardly eat at all, but I'd tried my best to eat it because I didn't want them to think I was rude. After a while, I was taken in the back of an open truck. It was quite mild, fortunately, to some other barracks in the heart of Berlin, I think this was. And we went to and it was full of rough fellows that had been shot down in the last day or two, perhaps the night before. And the row was terrific, of people talking. You didn't know anybody, but you know, you could have known them all your lives. But we all had to be careful of what we said, because we didn't know if there were microphones about. We then, somewhere about 4 or 5 o'clock, we were all put in a bus with a whole posse of Luftwaffe guards. And we were driven through Berlin to a mainline railway station. This was terribly exciting because you could see all the damage. You know, really, you were pleased about that. I think that we went down into the Linden because there are all these lime trees. We got to this railway station, a big railway station like St. Pancras or King's Cross or anywhere, and we were surrounded by these Luftwaffe guards, and there would be perhaps how many of us, I don't know, a dozen maybe, and all the people were showing the hostility towards us, poking umbrellas at us, spitting at us. We were very pleased for these Luftwaffe guards who were there to protect us. We got on this train, and just like they did here, the poor bloody natives had to stand in the corridor, but we went into a coach, a carriage. We were given some sandwiches, and then we set off and drove and travelled all through the night, stopping all the time, air raids, and, you know, it was very boring. It was completely dark. You got these dried up sandwiches. You began to feel then the homesickness somehow. Strangely enough, I miss telling you something. When I'd landed on this street in my parachute, one of the first things I thought of before I thought about getting into a shelter was, thank goodness that's over. And I meant that I wasn't going to have to go on ops anymore. I was so frightened. So anyway, I travelled all through the night, and in the morning we got to Frankfurt on Main. The two Frankfurts, there's Frankfurt on Oder, there's Frankfurt on Main, which is in western Germany. This was where the interrogation centre was. I hope I'm not going on too long.
Not at all.
No. We went out then. I think we must have gone by bus. It was daylight then. It was then, I suppose, about 8 o'clock in the morning. Been on the train all the night. And we went on this bus to what? Gulagluft, it was called. Gulagluft. This was the interrogation centre. Now, we had been told in England what to expect if ever we were a prisoner of war. So we had a vague idea what was going to happen. So we were all separated, never saw them anymore, into a cell. It must have been built during the war, I think, really, because when I say cell, it wasn't a stone thing with bars on the window. There probably were bars, but it was a wooden construction of a single story. Put in this thing, it would be, this room, it would be about 4 feet wide and about 8 feet long, I suppose, with a bed, with no mattress, and the door shut. After a while, the door opened and you were taken out and taken to another room, and there's a German sitting there wearing a great big Red Cross thing on his arm, purporting to be a Red Cross man, and he said, I've just a few questions, you know, I want you to answer. So that we can let your parents know you're safe and so forth. Right. What squadron are you from? Who's your squadron commander? Which station was it? So, I mean, you just say, sorry, I can't say this. Well, after about 10 minutes, I suppose he realised, I suppose everybody at first says nothing. So he said, well, you'll have to stop here till you tell us these things, and we can't be able to let your parents know that you're safe.